Let's take a look here at Margaret Sanger and a very important book, The Pivot of Civilization. And, most of the books that we've talked about, and it's been quite a rogues gallery, you know, if you're following along, I mean, you know, is there no bottom to the barrel when it comes to, depravity, to human depravity? Apparently there isn't any bottom to the barrel. We thought we'd probably bottomed out with Nietzsche, and it probably doesn't get any worse than that. But there's all kinds of variations on evil and debauchery and so on. And but most of these books and authors that we've talked about, there's nothing subtle about these people. Probably the most subtle would be Kant, and who we talked about early in the early in the class. But remember, Kant was actually a professing Christian, but he did put forth some philosophical concepts that I think led us off base, but nonetheless, he didn't do it, I don't think, intentionally. Now, with Margaret Sanger, again, there's nothing subtle about this woman. Now, what is her life and her writings all about? Well, essentially this. She's a strong proponent of a naturalistic view of sexuality that obviously has nothing to do with biblical moral values or anything like that. And so she believes that by nature we are sexual animals. She's an atheist, so we're just highly evolved animals. And traditional morality should have no bearing on our impulses and our activities, the way we live our life. But of course, she understands that there is a problem in that greater sexual activity and sexual expression can have consequences in unwanted pregnancies, okay? So therefore, she's going to consider birth control to be the greatest cause of our age, you know, as we enter into the 20th century. And she's very much a person of the 1920s and 30s and so on. And so she sees herself as very much of a modern 20th century woman. And so birth control is the greatest cause of our age. And therefore, birth control is what she would call, quote, the pivot of civilization. We've got to get a handle on human reproduction, because if we don't, it's going to continue to pollute and degrade the human gene pool, and that's anti-evolutionary, okay? So that's sort of Margaret Sanger, you might say, in a nutshell. And so in her book, The Pivot of Civilization, she tries to make the strongest case possible for birth control and abortion and eugenics. Now, I think there's a real logical progression. This woman is not an erratic thinker. She's a very logical, systematic thinker. And I don't think that you'll find a whole lot of irrational inconsistencies in her views. See, the problem is the whole foundation is skewed. Her whole worldview is corrupt. And so if you start with an unlevel foundation, you know, but you can build an edifice very logically, but it's not going to lead you to truth because the founding principles and presuppositions are wrong. And that's what we find with Margaret Sanger. But as we kind of work our way through her thinking and her lifestyle here, I think you'll find that this is a very logical expression and extrapolation and outgrowth of a secular, humanistic, atheistic worldview. You know, as we say, ideas have consequences. And Margaret Sanger is a perfect example, you know, of that concept. All right, so who is this person? Well, she's sometimes referred to as the godmother of the sexual revolution. Her mother, by the way, was a very devout Irish Catholic who went through 18 pregnancies. She lost 7 of those children. during pregnancy, but she gave birth to 11 children, and then her mother dies of tuberculosis and cervical cancer. Her father is a skilled craftsman, and his main occupation in his life is to sculpt angels and saints out of stone for gravestones, okay? But he's also what he calls a free thinker, which is what oftentimes atheists back in those days would describe themselves as, a free thinker. He was a socialist, and he was a strong proponent of women's rights. Now, one of her early influences was the very flamboyant agnostic orator Robert Ingersoll, whom her father greatly admired. Now, I don't know if that name means anything to you or not, but back in the late 1800s and turn of the century, Robert Ingersoll was an American celebrity. And probably he's best known for going around and giving speeches on atheism. And he's the one that would stand on stage and say, if there is a God, let him strike me dead with lightning right now, you know, and then, of course, nothing would happen, and so the audience would be thoroughly entertained, and, you know, that was his, you know, argument for the non-existence of God. So anyway, her father really thought Robert Ingersoll was a pretty clever guy. Now, Sanger herself is, by all accounts, a highly intelligent, articulate, attractive person, had a very charismatic personality. And in 1902, she marries a young architect from a wealthy family by the name of William Sanger, and she keeps his name the rest of her life. Now, for the first 10 years of their marriage, Margaret is a very dutiful wife and mother. They have three children. And again, they're pretty wealthy. They send their children to private schools and so on. But after a few years of conventional married life, she finds herself really, really bored and not challenged sufficiently. So in the year 1912, the family moves into Greenwich Village. And even back in these days, you know, just early in the 20th century, Greenwich Village was sort of the bohemian capital of America, you know. And then later in the 20th century, you know, kind of San Francisco becomes sort of a center. But Greenwich Village was also a very prominent bohemian center back in those days. And a lot of bohemian artists and writers and so on would come to Greenwich Village and socialize. And so she's an avowed atheist. She's a socialist. And she joins there in Greenwich Village, a group called the Liberal Club. And she enjoys associating with the intellectual left-wing elite of that day, people like Eugene Debs, the six-time presidential candidate for the Socialist Party, John Reed, a very famous American communist. If you saw the movie by Warren Beatty back in the 1980s, Reds, that's about John Reed and his on-and-off-again relationship with Elizabeth Bryant. And Emma Goldman, a notorious American communist, Upton Sinclair, well-known author, and so on. So that's the crowd that she hangs around with, and they consider themselves very enlightened, very cultured, very radical people. And it's during this time that she also reads a book that has a profound influence on her. It's called The Woman Movement, and it was written by a Swedish feminist by the name of Ellen Key. And this book advocates, quote, sexual liberation and open marriage. And from that point on, Sanger will pretty much absorb all the trendy left-wing bohemian ideas, you know, of her day. And she becomes a passionate advocate of birth control and abortion rights. And supposedly, she takes up the cause of abortion because a friend of hers dies from a self-induced abortion. But some of her biographers have actually kind of questioned whether or not that was actually even true or not. But anyway, after just a short time in Greenwich Village and this very open, bohemian, atmosphere, she decides that she doesn't want to be married anymore. And so she divorces her husband in 1913. And then she immediately launches a new periodical called The Rebel Woman. And this promotes women's rights, as they understood it back in those days, and contraception. And in that publication, it's Margaret Sanger who actually coins the term birth control. And she argues that every woman should be the absolute mistress of her own body. So, in the 1960s with the creation of the National Organization of Women now and groups like that, remember one of the mottos was, what was a woman's right to control her own body or something. Well, that basically comes from Margaret Sanger. Every woman should be the absolute mistress of her own body. Now, in 1916, she opens the first family planning clinic, birth control clinic in America, and she opens it up in Brooklyn. And a few days after she opens it, the police raid the facility, and they take her off to jail, and she's thrown in the jail for 30 days. But nonetheless, it just continues to spark this intense desire on her part as a crusader for abortion rights and so on. And so a few years after that, she organizes a group called the American Birth Control League. And the slogan of this American Birth Control League was, quote, "More children from the fit and less from the unfit." And that's going to be a major theme in Margaret Sanger's life and writings. And that is this idea that we need to take eugenics seriously because the gene pool of the human race is getting polluted. And we need to discourage or outright prohibit unfit people from breeding and procreating and encourage more procreation on the part of, the supposed fit elements in society. Now, she, of course, is divorced, has been divorced several years at this point, and she needs a benefactor. And so, again, like I said, she was apparently could be a very charming, charismatic person. And in 1921, she marries a very rich oil tycoon by the name of Noah Slee, and he provides the financial resources that she'll need to carry on and expand her work. Now, for Margaret Sanger, apparently being married to this guy was really just a marriage of convenience. They maintained separate residences. Apparently, they rarely ever slept together. But again, he's kind of her sugar daddy, Now, she begins to solicit more funding for more birth control clinics, and she finds the wealthiest patron possible, and that's John D. Rockefeller and Rockefeller's Bureau for Social Hygiene. So Rockefeller, very liberal, very generously begins contributing to Sanger, and she's able to really launch, an organization that's well-funded and really expands tremendously over the next several years. Now, in 1920, she writes a book called Woman and the New Race. And in that book, she calls abortion, quote, a disgrace to civilization. But it's a little misleading because, see, her opposition to abortion is based on the fact that abortion poses a danger to pregnant women. We need to make abortion legal and safe. And again, this movement, of course, it's going to take about 50 years, isn't it? But eventually this movement will gather steam throughout the 20th century. And eventually, of course, it'll become, the law of the land as the Supreme Court issues the Roe versus Wade decision, making abortion legal and, quote, safe. Now, abortion's never safe, of course, for the baby, is it? But anyway, that's not her concern. Now, a couple of years after that, she writes this book that we'll be talking about primarily called The Pivot of Civilization. And for the rest of her career, she's going to be a leader in family planning and population control movements. Now, by the way, this book, The Pivot of Civilization, is no longer available through Planned Parenthood, which she started, you know, in the 1940s. And on its website, Planned Parenthood concedes that, quote, Margaret Sanger entertains some popular ideas of her own time that are out of keeping with our thinking today, primarily her emphasis on eugenics, okay? And it goes on to say that Planned Parenthood finds these views objectionable and outmoded. So her emphasis on eugenics and also her explicitly racist ideas are an embarrassment to Planned Parenthood today. But nonetheless, Planned Parenthood has thrived, of course, off the primary contribution of Margaret Sanger, and that is to turn abortion into a legal movement in the United States. Now, as I said, in 1942, she founds Planned Parenthood. And over the last 50 years since abortion was declared legal by the Supreme Court, Planned Parenthood, as you know, has become the largest abortion mill in America. In 2014 alone, Planned Parenthood aborted about a third of a million babies, 330,000 babies. And you're probably aware of the fact that Planned Parenthood survives through the years primarily through federal grants that are provided by the American taxpayer. We actually pay for Planned Parenthood. And by the way, it's not an insignificant amount of money that they get. They get about $500 million, about $500 million every year. And that's we're contributing to that. Okay. Now, Sanger's views on sexuality and reproduction are influenced by a couple of sources, in particular, a strange British sexologist in the early 20th century by the name of Havelock Ellis. And Havelock Ellis was a physician. He was, again, a self-described expert on all matters related to sexuality. Most people kind of dismissed him as a crank, which he surely was a crank. But Ellis would argue that all sexual urges are normal, that there is no such thing as perversity. Perversity is just some kind of uptight categorization that Christians and others have forced on certain, you know, to alienate certain sexual practices. But anything that feels good or anything that you want to do, you know, there should be absolutely no moral qualms whatsoever. Now, Ellis himself was a prolific adulterer to the point that his wife, Edith, found solace in numerous lesbian affairs because, again, he was such an inattentive husband. He co-authored a book called Sexual Inversion, which he claimed was a medical textbook, and it was primarily on homosexuality, hence the title Sexual Inversion. You know, he's one of the first in the 20th century to be an avid promoter of homosexuality. And in fact, some researchers have actually said that Havelock Ellis actually is the person who coined the term homosexuality. Apparently, it wasn't really a word until, you know, the 20th century. Now, reportedly, Margaret Sanger has an affair with Havelock Ellis following her second divorce. But anyway, like Sanger, Ellis also was an advocate of eugenics. He believed that every aspect of a person's life, including their IQ, their biological and their medical condition, everything should be, as he put it, systematically registered, presumably in a public data bank, that would qualify them as fit or unfit to carry on the human race. So again, this is somebody who's really obsessed with population control, with eugenics. And he says, you know, the problem in our society, in America and Britain and Western society in general, is that the unfit are reproducing at too high a rate and the fit are not producing, you know, enough. So we need to have a national data bank, and we need to chart, you know, these characteristics of every individual, every citizen, and some citizens need to be forcibly sterilized. Now, Margaret Sanger never quite went to this length where she believed that the government should forcibly sterilize people, but she came very close to it, and never quite crossed the line. Now, Havelock Ellis, as I said, is sort of her sex guru, and based on his mentality and his writings, Margaret Sanger propagates sort of a quasi-spiritual and certainly a pseudo-scientific theory of sexuality. And according to Margaret Sanger, the greatest hindrance to human genius and to human self-expression is sexual repression. Now, where does she get this idea? Well, undoubtedly in part from Sigmund Freud. She never overtly credits Freud for this idea, but it sounds very, very Freudian, and so it's very likely that she had read him and was familiar with his theories related to repression that we talked about, you know, a couple of weeks ago. Now, in her writings, Sanger will promote, quote, the release of inner energies and the removal of, quote, the moral taboos that now bind the human body and spirit, freeing the individual from the slavery of tradition. And she puts it this way in The Pivot of Civilization. Hidden in the common stuff of humanity, presumably hidden in our human nature, lies buried the power of self-expression. Modern science is teaching us, actually modern science was not teaching this, but pseudoscience was teaching this, that genius is not some mysterious gift of the gods, some treasure conferred upon certain individuals chosen by chance, but rather it is due to the removal of physiological and psychological inhibitions and constraints which make possible the release and the channeling of our primordial inner energies of man into full and divine expression. You see what she's saying here? Now, does this remind you of any other theories that you're aware of on sexuality, that human creativity, human ingenuity comes from the free expression of our sexual impulses? When we repress those sexual impulses, we get real uptight and constricted on our thinking, okay? And it actually has an impact on our IQ, according to her, say. But if you live free and open and express yourself fully, then increasingly you develop new areas of interest and new areas of creativity. Now, again, does that ring a bell? Does that strike anybody? Does that sound familiar at all to anything that came before? I think you could deduce that from Sigmund Freud. But she's speaking as if it's actually kind of a quasi-spiritual experience. But, of course, she's an atheist, like Freud was. To an extent. But if you're familiar with the old Hindu tantric sex manual, the Kama Sutra. You familiar with the Kama Sutra? I think that must be where she got a lot of this, okay, although she never actually attributes it to the Kama Sutra. But it sounds very much like that sex is a spiritual experience, and therefore the more experimental and creative you get, the more spiritually satisfying it becomes, I suppose. So she goes on to say that the removal of these inhibitions, these moral constraints, So scientists assure us, and again, she's talking about scientists like Sigmund Freud, and as we said a couple of weeks ago, Freud is mostly a philosopher of a particular view of psychology. He's rarely ever a true scientist, but anyway, the removal of these inhibitions, as scientists assure us, make possible more rapid and profound perceptions. See, we become, again, we expand our mind. So rapid indeed that they seem to be intuitive. The qualities of genius are not, therefore, qualities lacking in the common reservoir of humanity, but rather unimpeded release and direction of powers that are latent in all of us. See? So in other words, she's basically saying we can expand our IQ and we can become more creative people through the full expression of our sexual impulses. In other words, creative and self-satisfying sexual activity, see, is related to IQ, and it's the key, as far as she sees it, it's the key to the evolution of human intelligence. Or again, as Sanger puts it, sex is a creative and pleasurable form of self-expression that contributes to our mental and psychic development, as well as to our overall health and satisfaction. And she goes on to say, let us look forward to this great release of creative and constructive energy that will propel humanity onward and upward to new heights of scientific and artistic accomplishment. Okay. So, again, that's been a common theme, hasn't it, among sexual revolutionaries in the 20th century. And obviously, people without a truly sacred understanding of human nature can easily be caught up in this. And obviously, there's a lot of attraction to this in a free and prosperous society like America and like Western Europe in the 20th century. Any comments or questions before we move on? So you might say that she's coming out with these theories at a time when American society and Western society in general are more than eager to hear this kind of a message and to enthusiastically embrace this kind of message. The only restraints on this kind of a message would be traditional biblical moral values. Okay. Hence the culture war. And as we know, a major aspect of the culture war has always been areas of sexuality. Any thoughts, comments, anything before we move on? Yeah, Bob?
It seemed to me that the church probably was lacking in attention to the positive, creative, God-ordained sacredness of sex.
Right.
All they taught was taboos.
That's right.
So the population was ready to receive something like this.
Yes, and you're absolutely right, I think, and that is, you know, as we understand, the previous age in Western civilization was what we call a Victorian age, and there were some unhealthy repressions, that were normative in that day. So I think you're right. I mean, without a truly biblical and holistic understanding of, for instance, sexuality, then an uptight view of sexuality can certainly be exploited by sexual libertines like Margaret Sanger, obviously. So the main hang-up to this whole evolutionary process, see, is what she calls the abolition of the shame and fear of sex. And as Sanger puts it, through sex, mankind may attain the great spiritual illumination which will transform the world, which will light up the only path to an earthly paradise. I mean, let me read that again. I mean, wow. Through sex, mankind may attain the great spiritual illumination, which will transform the world, which will light up the only path to an earthly paradise. Wow. What an apostle, What an evangelist for her position. And in fact, the woman could at times wax absolutely euphoric about the joys of sexual liberation. But I think we've probably quoted her on this matter probably quite enough, so I won't subject you to any more. But suffice it to say that this is a message, see, that people in the post-Victorian jazz age, in other words, the 1920s, the jazz age, Americans and people in Britain and Europe are very eager to hear and believe what she's putting out. Say, actually, I guess we should say they're not only eager to hear and believe, they're eager to put in practice, you know, what she's putting out. And, you know, when we look at this transition from what we call the Victorian age and Victorian morality and so on to the jazz age and so on, we shouldn't neglect a major influence, and that was World War I, which just absolutely disrupted the status quo that had been in effect for generations and even centuries in Western civilization. World War I, you might say, just blew apart the consensus of the past, the philosophical and the religious consensus of the past. And this is what major wars like that can do. Wars of that magnitude are oftentimes major watershed events in human history. We saw it here, you know, in the Civil War in America. Things were drastically different after the Civil War from before, and certainly World War I, and then again 20 years later, World War II as well. So, again, any comments, questions, anything before we move on? All right, well, let's take a look here at her views on society and eugenics. Now, according to Sanger, humanity's chronic problem is certainly not evil caused by sin, but rather it's a lack of education. And you hear this from liberals and secularists and humanists all the time. You know, our problem is a lack of education. Hence, we've got to pour tons and tons more money into education. And the more we spend, nothing ever improves. Because our fundamental problem is actually not ignorance and a lack of education. Fundamentally, our problem is human nature and our sin nature. But secularists aren't about to concede that, and certainly Margaret Sanger was not. So she says, you know, our main problem in our society is certainly not evil or sin, but rather it's that we've got too many stupid people of low intelligence. And so, as she puts it, the greatest present menace to civilization is a lack of balance between the birth rate of the fit and the unfit. And she says, you know, the unfit, well, those are people that are mentally retarded and they are poverty stricken. And she writes that the most urgent problem of today is how to limit and discourage the overfertility of the mentally and the physically defective. So she takes this popular IQ test of the day, the Stanford-Binet test. I don't know when that ever faded away. I don't think it's, Julie, nobody uses that anymore, do they? Or? Yeah, yeah, I know. It was in the 70s at least. And okay, so based on the Stanford-Binet test, she determines the unfit to be those who have IQ significantly below average. And, you know, back in those days, they classified people according to this rigid one-size-fits-all IQ test. And so if you had an IQ of under 70, you know, like 50 to 70, then you were classified officially as a moron. And if you had an IQ from about 25 to 50, you were officially classified an imbecile. And if you had an IQ of 0 to 25, you were officially classified an idiot. And I mean, is that possible to have an IQ of 0? I mean, you would think a blade of grass has an IQ higher than 0 or something. But anyway, according to Sanger, see, people like this are a menace to our race, and they should never have been born, as she puts it. Yet, these are the kind of people, she complains, who are our most prolific breeders. And so Of course, her views here are being influenced by Darwin, among others. And according to Darwin, intelligence and morality are evolved traits that are passed on hereditarily. And Darwin regarded the mentally retarded as examples of evolutionary reversion, as he puts it. See, and they're holding back the whole process of human evolution. Or as Darwin put it, quote, "The very poor and reckless, who are often degraded by vice, almost invariably marry early in life and produce many more children, while the careful and the frugal people, who are otherwise generally virtuous, tend to marry later in life so that they may be able to support themselves and their children in comfort." And in his book, The Descent of Man, Darwin writes that the careless, the squalid, the lethargic Irishman, and remember back in these days in American history, and of course British history in the late 1800s and early 20th century, many Europeans considered the Irish to be the very bottom of the barrel when it came to the Caucasian race. And Darwin believed that as well. Being English, he thought Irishmen were very much inferior. So Darwin writes that the careless, the squalid, lethargic Irishman multiplies like rabbits. But the frugal, foreseeing, self-respecting Scot, on the other hand, stern in his morality, spiritual in his faith, disciplined in his intelligence, passes his best years in struggle and in celibacy. He marries late and leaves few behind. Now, given a land originally peopled by, let's say, 1,000 Scots and 1,000 Irishmen, or in other words, peopled by 1,000 Saxons and 1,000 Celts, okay, and in 12 generations, he says, 5/6 of the population then would eventually be Celts or Irishmen. But 5/6 of all the property and power and intellect would belong to that other 1/6 of the population, the Saxons, the English. In the eternal struggle for existence, it would be the inferior and less favored race, the Irish, that had prevailed, and prevailed by virtue not of its good qualities, but of its faults. So as we were making the case a couple of weeks ago, I mean, Darwin was a classic racist. And again, that's a word that we'd want to use with great discretion, because it's thrown around almost always erroneously these days. But there is such a thing as racism, and racism is simply the belief that some races are inherently genetically inferior and others are superior. And by that definition, which is the pure definition of racism, Charles Darwin was a racist, as were a lot of these people like Margaret Sanger, for instance. So, similarly, Sanger argues that the unfit in society, number one, they're a problem because they pollute the gene pool in society. Or, as she put it, organized charity is a symptom of a malignant social disease. Instead of decreasing and aiming to eliminate the stocks of people that are the most detrimental to the race of the world, it tends to render them, to a menacing degree, dominant. So she's arguing, see, against social welfare. She says all social welfare does is help sustain and perpetuate the very least fit people in our society. Now, again, this is very odd, see, because by all standards back in her day, Margaret Sanger was what we would call a liberal, extremely liberal. Back then, progressive. And yet she's arguing, say, in her concern for eugenics, that social welfare programs should be totally eliminated because all it does is help sustain the worst people in our society and drag our society down. Now, not only do they pollute the gene pool, but secondly, the unfit increase the levels of degeneracy, crime, and poverty in our society. And she'll put it this way: modern studies indicate that insanity, epilepsy, criminality, prostitution, poverty, and mental defect are all organically bound up together. You can insanity, epilepsy, criminality, prostitution, poverty, mental defect, these are all integrally connected. And that the least intelligent and the most thoroughly degenerate classes in every community are the most prolific. These are the people that breed the most, see. Feeble-mindedness in one generation becomes poverty or insanity in the next, she says. So that's another problem with sustaining the unfit in society. It contributes to social degeneracy, crime, and poverty. Thirdly, these people create a burden on the rest of society, which has to support them. And the rest of society has to support them in terms of public education and welfare programs, and we have to build insane asylums and mental hospitals and stuff like that, see? Or, as she puts it, the actual dangers of sustaining the unfit can only be fully realized when we have acquired definite information concerning the financial and the cultural costs of these classes in our community, when we become fully cognizant of the burden of the imbecile upon the whole human race, when we see the funds that should be available for human development, for scientific and artistic and philosophical research, instead having to be diverted by hundreds of millions of dollars into the care and the segregation of men and women and children who should never have been born. So she'll argue, see, that those who provide free, for instance, health care and free maternity care for the poor and the unfit are only increasing, in her words, the dead weight of human waste. The dead weight of human waste. So the poor, the unfit, they create a burden on the rest of society, which has to pay for their upkeep and survival. Fourthly, she says, you know, the poor and the unfit, the uneducated, the ignorant, the imbeciles, and so on, they degrade our political system, which depends upon an intelligent and a public-spirited citizenry. And she writes it this way. In a democracy like the United States, every man and woman is permitted to vote in the government, and it is the representatives of this lower class of intelligence who may destroy our liberties. Equality of political power has been bestowed upon the lowest elements in our population. We must not be surprised, therefore, at the spectacle of political scandal and graft. You know, these people are major contributors, she says, to political graft and corruption and scandal. Because, again, they're so ignorant, they don't even know what's going on. And the flagrant stupidity exhibited by our legislative bodies. She goes on to say, the congressional record mirrors our political imbecility. Now, again, see, Margaret Sanger, as I said, is the prototypical secular liberal of the early 20th century. And yet you hear her saying a lot of things that liberals would recoil from today, see. So what do you think happened anyway? See, in other words, why did people like Sanger, people who 100 years ago called themselves progressives, now they would call themselves liberals, why did they begin to promote policies and programs that instead of discouraging equal opportunity and equal rights for the poor and the, quote, unfit, instead they actually cater to the lower classes in society today? So why do you think that might be the case?
Guilt.
Like what, for instance? What kind of guilt? Okay, so and again, to be specific, What's the guilt? What's the source of the guilt?
Guilt over slaves.
Okay.
America,
okay.
All right.
Okay. So guilt over America's racist past, and the horrible exploitation of black people in America in the past. Okay. What other kind of guilt might be a factor here? How okay? Let me help me think through that. What do you have in mind there?
Because part of it was
Yes. Okay, I see your point. Okay, so the racism inherent in Nazism and the Holocaust and all, not to be humorous about it because it's not funny at all, but. As Benjamin Weicker writes in his book 10 Books That Screwed Up the World, he says, Hitler and the Nazis and the Holocaust gave eugenics a bad name. See, actually, before the Holocaust, again, liberals were pretty much on board with the whole eugenics program. But Hitler and the Nazis went too far, okay? And so since then, liberals have wanted nothing to do with eugenics. So I think Ray's also right in the sense that race has been a guilt factor. But also, what about people who are raised in very affluent families, living off inherited wealth and trust funds and so on? They understand that they did nothing whatsoever to deserve this privileged position they hold in society. And that also undoubtedly would be a factor. Wayne?
What about, did they ever just realize that in a democracy that it was useful to have a pool of people that could be led easily?
Okay. Can you kind of take that to the next step? What do you exactly have in mind there?
Well, rather than getting rid of what would now be labeled low-information voters,
mm-hmm. Okay, the less educated, the less informed, the less aware they are, the more they can be manipulated and exploited. Okay, and yeah, I think that's very much of a factor in the transition here from the mentality of liberals who 100 years ago had abject contempt for the uneducated and the poor. Now, politically, they exploit them regularly for their own political gain. Okay. Yeah, good point. Any other thoughts, Bob?
Just to go along with that, I think it goes further back to FDR and mm-hmm. Johnson and those people. I mm-hmm. think they it's sort of cynical, but I think that the more you have on social welfare programs, it's kind of like getting something for nothing, and it's buying votes. So I think really part of it by the elitists is that's a way they can keep, that's a handy way to keep in power.
Yeah, absolutely. By pandering and promising more and more out of the public treasury in return for votes. Okay. Well, Sanger never advocated compulsory euthanasia, unlike the Nazis. But she does fervently promote forced sterilization in the case of what she called irresponsible and unfit parents. For the good of human evolution, inferior humans should be forcibly sterilized. Or as she put it, each feeble-minded person is a potential source of endless progeny of defect. In other words, they just keep cranking out babies, inferior babies. Therefore, we prefer the policy of immediate sterilization so that parenthood is absolutely prohibited to the feeble-minded. Now, if American society and politicians don't act, she says, to drastically reduce all this random and chaotic breeding of the lower classes, the gene pool will be forever polluted, and again, our political system will suffer as a result. So what percentage of the population would she recommend be forcibly sterilized? And she kind of vacillates. At first she says, oh, at least 10%, you know, because these are the imbeciles, the morons, and the idiots, okay? So at least 10%. But she also notes that when the U.S. went to war in 1917, it was determined by the U.S. Army that 38% of the men were rejected because of physical ill health and defects. And she goes on to say, in another psychological examination of drafted men, nearly half had the mentality of 12-year-old children or less. In other words, they were morons. Okay, so she references another study that indicates that as much as 45% of the entire population, quote, will never develop mental capacity beyond the stage represented by a normal 12-year-old child. So it sounds like, according to Margaret Sanger, about half the American people are hopeless and should be deprived of procreating. And so anyway, her argument for selective breeding and for forced sterilization appears just a few years before Hitler addressed this same issue in his book Mein Kampf. But again, unlike Darwin and Hitler, who focused on genetic differences primarily between races, Sanger emphasizes the problem of low intelligence in general. Now, she was a racist, without a doubt, but that's not primarily her concern. But with Hitler, race is primarily the problem, okay? But anyway, the end result is more or less the same as far as both of them are in their advocacy. Now, let's take a look here at her legacy, and then we'll do an assessment and critique of Margaret Sanger. Her legacy today is certainly felt when it comes to the trend toward genetically engineered designer babies. Through fetal screening, many prospective parents are choosing to terminate the lives of babies that are considered less than perfect physically or mentally. So, for instance, many parents are opting for surrogate egg or sperm donors in order to produce children with specific physical and mental characteristics, even down to the color of one's eyes, height, weight, body shape, certainly IQ. So this is becoming more and more normative in our society, as I'm sure you know. Benjamin Weicker puts it this way: those who stand in the way of eugenic utopia will be considered enemies of human progress. Now, a perfect example of the legacy of Margaret Sanger is the Princeton bioethicist Peter Singer. So Peter Singer, influenced by Margaret Sanger, okay? And perhaps you've heard of Peter Singer. The man is very notorious. And Singer proposes a more radical solution to the problem of inferior humanity. Singer is an enthusiastic supporter of, quote, animal rights. And he favors infanticide and euthanasia for humans with mental disabilities, or what he calls non-contributing elderly people. Now, kind of like the ancient, Spartans. According to Singer, we should allow doctors and parents to carefully examine infants to determine whether or not these infants are fit for living or not. And those with serious defects should be subjected, in his words, to fourth trimester abortions. In other words, they should be euthanized. Now, how long does it take to examine a newborn infant to determine whether or not he or she meets your standards? And Singer puts it this way. He says, I suggest that a period of 28 days after birth might be allowed before an infant is accepted as having the same right to life as others. So if he had his way, and again, now, This guy is highly influential. Again, he teaches at Princeton, one of the premier, quote, bioethicists of our generation. And he says that parents ought to be allowed to kill their babies up to, you know, his guess is about 28 days, you know, maybe 27. We could even stretch it to 29 or 30. Or what? How about 2 months? You know, then you've got a little bit better idea of what you've got here. Say, actually 3 months would be even better, wouldn't it? So, after all, he argues, virtually all animals, including even pigs and chickens and fish, have more signs of consciousness and rationality than do newborn infants. I don't know if you've thought about that or not. But a newborn chicken or pig shows more signs of development than a newborn human baby, you know. So what would stand in the way of this kind of a utopian horror? Well, Singer accuses Christians in particular of practicing what he calls speciesism. In other words, Christians are guilty of regarding human beings as superior to other life forms. And of course, that makes no sense whatsoever if you buy into the naturalistic evolutionary view of life. We are more, potentially, we're more highly evolved intellectually than fish and chickens and pigs. But other than that, I mean, we're still just animal life forms. And so to think that human beings are better than other life forms, you're guilty of political incorrectness. You're guilty of speciesism. And you probably hear this term occasionally, you know, from the so-called animal rights radicals of our day, of which Singer is one of those. So Singer argues that we need to remove Homo sapiens from their privileged position and restore the natural order, which means more rights for animals and less special treatment for human beings. So again, if you buy into the whole worldview of somebody like Peter Singer or Margaret Sanger, actually, this is a fairly rational way of looking at things. Comments? Yeah, Wayne? Mm-hmm.
Is there any element or any connection to, say, the climate change community to any of this, in that climate change is a result of human action, and therefore, in order to correct it, we need fewer humans?
We're the ones polluting the environment and causing climate change. And
those Christians are having a lot of children that they shouldn't be having.
Yeah, precisely. That's certainly one demographic group that we wouldn't want to breed prolifically. But, you know, if we can capture their children, throw them into government schools, maybe we can straighten them out. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, I'm just thinking, I'm also thinking about Bob's summary of what the church should have done back in the 1920s. You know, I've read, and I think we may have covered it somewhere along the classes. All political, generally, statistically, it shows that you can't change laws without the culture coming along.
Right.
Trends.
Yes.
You know, the homosexuality, the gay rights, they've been coming for, 25 years or more. And directionally coming in that way.
Right.
As is a lot of these ideas. And it seems to me.
And it's like a gathering tidal wave, isn't it? It's like a tidal wave.
Sure. You can't get those things through without that culture change.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
And say, I see this tidal wave beginning. And speaking out it into. And talking, you know, very frank into the issues. That guy you had last year who wrote the big book from Westminster, he spoke about the political 1922. He had done a study, wrote his book. I would bet have gone through people's minds in today's culture in terms of the, you know, the statistics.
Yeah.
But what are we doing to address that? And I'm talking about from the church's perspective and going in, because otherwise the culture will come back and repeat itself here.
Yeah, it's a lot safer just to retreat into the enclave of a church where everybody pretty much agrees with you, because it's risky to go out into the public square and try to counter a lot of these trends. For one thing, you've got to be able to articulate not only what you believe, but why you believe these things, why they're rational and factual and so on. In other words, apologetics. And so for generations, the church put absolutely no emphasis on apologetics whatsoever. So Christians had very strong convictions, but they couldn't possibly defend them when attacked and challenged, you know. So that's one thing we should be very grateful for in the last 25 or 30 years, that apologetics has become more of a factor in at least some churches, although never to the extent that it should be. But it's just more comfortable just to retreat. You know, when you look at what is it that shapes our culture? Well, in other words, where does our culture in general get its values? And obviously, from the education system, from, you know, elementary all the way to academia, higher education. And Christians began pretty much abandoning academia and all more than 100 years ago. Where else do we get our values? Well, from the media, how they shape the issues, whether they ridicule traditional Christian biblical beliefs or whether they give them fair treatment in the media. And of course, when it comes to what used to be the primary means by which people got their understanding of the news and current events, it was television, you know. Maybe not as quite as much now with the internet, but the media, liberal secularists had an absolute monopoly until Fox News, and many of us have serious reservations about Fox News, but at least you hear conservative alternative opinions on Fox News. It did break the liberal monopoly on television news. And where else? Well, from the entertainment biz. TV, movies, music, these have just an incredible influence on our culture and how people think and the shaping and formation of cultural values. What about the legal profession? Overwhelmingly, most of our politicians are lawyers, and so the legal profession obviously has a very strong influence as well. And so when you think about it, all of these major cultural forces are absolutely dominated by secular, liberal, anti-Christian values. And even many of our churches. We had the forum last month with Mark Tooley talking about the state of the mainline Protestant denominations, which by and large have just totally capitulated and sold out to the culture, to the secular culture. And so this is what shapes people's values and understanding. And they are overwhelmingly anti-Christian, not just un-Christian, but absolutely anti-Christian.
But which comes first?
Which comes first?
Chicken or the egg. In other words, you're saying that this is predominantly liberally owned.
Uh-huh.
The question I've got is, where is the Christian conservative groups that are speaking, I mean, really going after and speaking? Have we withdrawn from that because it's ugly?
Mm-hmm. And dangerous to your career, by the way. Yeah.
Well, that wasn't necessarily true 20 years ago. But we have systematically been withdrawing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It didn't just all occur in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So why I'm saying is seminaries, us?
I don't know. They're about 50 years behind the times, frankly, when it comes to these issues.
Yeah.
They don't talk about this kind of stuff in seminary, generally speaking. And that's regrettable, to say the least. You know, they're not really addressing a lot of the salient issues of our day. So is there any place where we could begin changing all this? Well, the more domination you have of secular liberals in these other areas, the more intolerant they become. You know, they all ride around in cars with bumper stickers that say tolerance and coexist and all, but they're among the most intolerant people imaginable. They certainly are not tolerant when it comes to Christians and Christian beliefs and values. So, look, if it doesn't happen here, it just doesn't happen. And that's why it's, as we've talked about before, it's only in churches where you could have honest education take place. And so many churches, including so many prominent churches, not only don't emphasize education, but many of them are, frankly, anti-education. I mean, some of our biggest, most prestigious megachurches in America have absolutely no adult education component, or for that matter, any education component as it relates to college students and young adults, you know. So this is pathetic beyond belief. But this is, now again, there's a trickle of Christians into these other fields, but oftentimes they feel such pressure to compromise because, again, these non-Christian forces are so hostile to Christian values and beliefs and so intolerant. Jay?
Mm-hmm.
Good question. Well, there's far more Christians who are a whole lot more interested in March Madness than they are in what's going on in our culture. You know, March Madness, the NCAA basketball tournament. Yeah, Bob.
Statistics say in America that it takes 1,000 Christians to win one single conference.
Oh,
so
wow.
So losing the battle continues.
Wow.
The thing that ties to this is that most Christians, if you ask them why they don't witness, and the vast majority of Christians don't do any witnessing or discipling.
Right.
It's because they're afraid that somebody would ask them a question that they feel stupid and couldn't get an answer on. They don't have to become scientists or historians completely, but at least to know the general answer they can give to a person to get back to the gospel.
That's right. That's
so they're
right.
Not getting the gospel because they don't have apologetics.
Which is apologetics. See? And see, so many church leaders think that apologetics, that's just kind of a peripheral side issue for, you know, a handful of Christians that don't have anything better to do with their time. They don't understand how integral to discipleship and to evangelism apologetics is. In other words, you know, they're very eager to tell us what we ought to believe, right? But how often do they tell us why to believe these things? Why should we believe them, see? And how could you defend your faith when challenged? So the most compelling argument for apologetics, I just ask people very simply, wouldn't you like to broaden and deepen your understanding of the Christian faith so that you can explain and defend your beliefs more effectively to non-Christians? That, very simply, is the value and the purpose of apologetics. It's not some highly esoteric intellectual pursuit. I mean, it can be, but that's not fundamentally what apologetics is. It's just so that you can be confident in sharing your faith. And if somebody actually asks you a question, you won't just totally fall apart. Yes, Cindy, you had a comment. Oh, yeah, there is that. Yes.
They will make the church whatever, you know, they will have to pay taxes or something if they keep certain things.
Yes.
They're getting into
that,
but that's terrible.
Yeah, yeah, it is a lack of courage and lack of faith. You know, if we preach the truth, we obviously are going to offend people. You know, if you look at what Margaret Sanger believed, so much of what she believed, as I said, is very rational and logical, unless you have an understanding of a Christian worldview and a Christian view of human nature. A lot of her criticisms of the poor and the dangers of allowing the poor, you know, sustaining the poor, and they corrupt our society, they're crime-ridden, drug-ridden, they corrupt our political system and so on, isn't that true in many respects, see? The problem with Margaret Sanger is she doesn't believe in the sanctity of human life. When you believe in the sanctity of human life, when you believe that human beings are a special creation by God, that were made in the Imago Dei, it changes radically everything. It changes how you look at human beings. You don't look at human beings as how can these people contribute to our society and our culture. Yeah, I mean, That is important, but it's not the most important thing about human beings. The most important thing is they have a soul, and that's to be honored and cultivated and nurtured, you know, to the utmost. She doesn't believe in that, and I would say the same thing for I always found Neil Bortz, the radio talk show host, very entertaining. Sometimes he could be absolutely incisive, and then other times he's just a total blowhard, you know, but see, remember, Neil Bortz would never allow anybody to even use the word abortion on his program. He refused to deal with it. And I was always convinced that the reason he wouldn't allow any discussion of abortion is because, frankly, he's glad that we have so many abortions in America, because disproportionately, the babies being aborted are poor, black, other minorities. And he's convinced that if all these millions of babies were allowed to be born and live, it would be all the more of a drain on our national resources. See, now, you can make a logical case. The problem is, he doesn't believe in the sanctity of life. And that's what makes all the difference, see. So, again, you build a house on a skewed foundation. Even more skewed than that. And you can build, you know, a logical structure, but it's off-center. It doesn't reach truth because the foundation itself is skewed and flawed. And that's the problem with a secular humanistic worldview. It's a very flawed view of reality and of God and of human nature.